Okay, hello everyone. Thank you for joining us on our World Peace Diet Circle call for August 15th, 2019. We are delighted to be able to join together in consciousness to explore the consequences of animal agriculture and the consequences of and benefits, really, of questioning the routine abuse of animals for food and other products in a whole variety of different ways. So thanks for joining us. Again, I know there's a lot, we're all busy with 10,000 things, and it's sometimes hard to squeeze these things in, so it's great that we can meet like this. And I want to just say at the beginning that your input is most welcome. And feel free to, at any point, press *6, and you'll be able to raise your hand that way and comment or say something. So let's see. What should we start with? Now, this has been a great month. There's been a lot of positive things happening in the vegan movement, I'd say, around the world. We can talk about some of those things. And, of course, there's been lots of challenges as well on many levels for animals and for ecosystems and for people. But it's a great time to be alive, and I think we're definitely adding every day to the momentum, the snowball effect, we sometimes call it, of the vegan movement, and as it continues to just reach and penetrate more and more deeply into Western society and I think all around the world, and it's just growing every day. People are working hard and helping to contribute to this movement. So I want to thank all of you, because I know if you're on this call, you are contributing in your own ways, and it's very important that we understand how significant this really is, because this is a team effort, and we all have our unique capacities that we can contribute. So we're going to be joined today, hopefully, by a woman named Gina Sakara. She will be on with us for a little while, I think pretty soon. I don't see her on here yet, but she agreed to chat with us a little bit about her work as an animal advocate, especially for wild animals. So I'll tell you more about her in a few minutes. So let's go ahead and begin our time as we normally do, just having a short meditation. And I'm hoping that you can all hear me okay. I'm using a little bit different system. I'm using a speakerphone instead of my earpiece. I'm going to try that out. All right, so here we go. So let's wherever you happen to be, feel free to make yourself comfortable and pay attention if you're driving, of course, and turn our attention within for a few minutes together and just begin by feeling our connection with this beautiful planet, wherever we happen to be, the Earth, and the enormous celebration of life here in countless forms that no human being can ever begin to comprehend, in complexity and vastness, in the oceans and in the forests and the rivers and the prairies and lakes and streams and the skies. The miraculous beauty of this earth. And just give thanks that we have another day to be on this beautiful earth and to appreciate and savor the beauty around us and to contribute in some way to this beauty by appreciating it, by taking time to notice the way the leaves turn toward the light and flutter in the breeze, the way the birds fly in and out among the branches and play and communicate with each other, and all the whole web of life here. This is really the underlying reason for our work, is the love for creation, the love for the celebration of life here, the sense of caring and responsibility that we have as human beings, which is a natural to our basic wisdom when we see that we have enormous capacities to destroy the creation with our technology, with our choices, how we consume and what we do with our daily lives. So we give thanks for this precious opportunity of a human birth to learn and to grow and to deepen our connection with our inner wisdom and compassion and sensitivity. And we give thanks for the whole web of other human beings that we're connected to who also have a shared passion for nurturing and caring for this earth. We give thanks knowing that we're each unique. We may not agree on every little aspect of the strategies and things, but the underlying idea of liberating animals and liberating humans, human animals, and liberating ourselves to be a force for healing and awakening in our world. That our precious human life is leading. So we give thanks for every moment of every day. And we give thanks knowing that all of the ripples that radiate out into the world from our being together on this call here this afternoon or this evening will be ripples to help increase consciousness, awareness, and mindfulness, compassion, and sensitivity, and respect for all expressions of life. And that our own minds and hearts will continue to mature and to evolve and develop so that we can more and more fully embody the teaching of ahimsa, nonviolence, which is the root teaching of vegan living, the world peace diet, the world peace way of living. And so we give thanks that we are part of this awakening of human consciousness on planet Earth at this time, that the continued unfoldment of our consciousness is our greatest passion, and we're dedicated to that. And we give thanks, knowing this is so, and so it is. All right, so thanks everyone again for joining together in the meditation that we're sharing. We usually have one of those at the very beginning of every call. And I always, as you all know, I'm sure, try to emphasize that I think that the whole thrust in many ways of the vegan movement is really twofold. You know, it's not only to go out and change the world, but it's, I think, at an even more important level to help transform our own awareness and our consciousness and our way of living, our relationships with nature, with animals, with our friends and colleagues, and our family, our online relationships, so that we ourselves are living examples of the truth of ahimsa and nonviolence, of respect and patience and understanding for the woundedness of ourselves and others, so that we can be forces of healing and less to be forces of judgment and blame. And so that puts in many ways the ball in our court, that is how we line ourselves up every day. And that's why I think meditation is such an important ally, because our mind is our greatest gift and our greatest ally, too. It can also be an impediment if it's not clear. So remember last month I went on and on for a while about clarity and how important it is for us to do the best we can to maximize the clarity in our consciousness. And I think meditation is an essential way to do this, because it has to do with listening, with learning to listen and to be receptive to what's around us and what's within us, rather than continuing to just enact patterns that have been injected into us by our society and by our parents and teachers and all the ads on TV, the culture. It's a collection of concepts and ideas and commitments and convictions that we have a certain loyalty to, a certain story. And to be able to question that narrative and replace the narrative with the living awareness of our interconnectedness with all life, so that we're functioning from the living presence of our awareness in our connection with the earth and others and animals and people, rather than the story that in many ways just disconnects us from what's real. Both the beauty of life all around us and also from the tragedy of what we're doing every day. You know, the official narratives in our society, in many ways, they function to destroy both our appreciation of the beauty and miraculous nature of life and of each other and the wonder of our lives. You know, the narrative in our society trivializes virtually all of that, turns everything into a commodities and all of us into instruments. And then the enormous abuse of animals and ecosystems is also trivialized. The narrative also just makes that normal too. Everything's normalized in a way that I think dumbs us down as a society and as individuals. And I think it's rooted in animal agriculture. Ultimately, it's rooted in animal agriculture because the act of eating meat and dairy requires us to disconnect from the wide awake awareness that is a hallmark of being a conscious being. So thank you all for, in some way, embodying in an increasing way every day this understanding and bringing it to the work that we are here to bear witness to. And I think together we can continue to grow and learn in this direction. So, all right, so that's it. That's basically what I want to say to start out here, that this twin aspect of reducing awareness of both the beauty and the tragedy, I think the more we get sensitized to the beauty around us and the magnificence and wonder of creation and of our own minds and hearts and our awareness, the more we're also sensitized to what the heck is going on. How can we be crushing and destroying and paving over and cutting down and marketing all of this in a way that renders it all meaningless? What's going on here? How did it all happen? How can we contribute to the healing of this kind of a situation? So it's really both enormously, I think, invigorating and joy-invoking and also traumatizing. that's the problem. It's excruciatingly painful to understand all these connections and to sensitize ourselves, and yet it's enormously liberating. And it's important, I think, to really embrace the positive aspect of how we grow much more joyful as well as we become more committed and perhaps feel the pain of the suffering of creation more intensely. We're more alive. And as Gibran said, you've heard me say it probably, you know, when we're awake, we can laugh all of our laughter and we cry all of our tears until we laugh. Until we feel and cry our tears, we won't be able to laugh all of our laughter. I think, you know, this is such an important point, to open up to the suffering, and that opens us up to the great, great joy and liberation as well. So we're all appreciative, I think, of each other's courage in doing this. So I'd like to go ahead now and introduce our guest, Gina Sequeira, and she's with us. Thank you, Gina, for being here. I can see that you're with us on my screen here. So I'd like to say a few words about Gina, and then I'll unmute her, your phone, Gina. So let's go ahead and get started with this. So Gina, I mean, the way I essentially learned about Gina primarily was through her book, which is Lolita Loves the Ocean, The Story of a Wild Orca, which just came out a couple of, about a year ago, I guess, a year and a half ago. And she wrote the whole book, and it's somewhat of a children's book, although it's more involved and extensive than a typical children's book. And so it's, I think it's very interesting for adults, too. She did a lot of the art in there as well. And I remember years ago being in Florida, and we went to the screening of a film about Lolita. And it was made by a wonderful young couple who was dedicated to trying to free, like we, you know, free Willie. Well, this is free Lolita. Lolita is a beautiful killer whale, orca, who was captured off the coast of in Washington State, I guess, off of by Seattle up there, and brought down to this horrible, tiny little tank in Miami, where she's been living now for decades. And, you know, she's just, I don't know how she does it. It's a terrible, terrible situation. It's a tiny little, horrible little tank. And she had another orca in there for a while, but I think he died. So she's been alone. And the guy that owns it, you know, there's been all kinds of protests, and he just refuses to. It's like this is his particular thing. So anyway, I really appreciated her sensitive and deep portrayal of the plight of these animals. And to me, there's a huge, you know, importance, of course, in all of us going vegan and moving away from eating animal foods. But I think also that we educate ourselves about the plight of free living animals at human hands. There's just so much stealing and killing of wild living animals, besides the terrible destruction of the enslaved animals who are imprisoned by us. And so I think this is something that Gina has devoted herself to. She's got quite a background as a professional writer and researcher, and she's got a master's degree from San Francisco State University, which means I also have a master's from San Francisco State. And she also has done quite a bit of doctoral research through the University of Hong Kong. And it was fascinating to read how she lived in the wilds of Madagascar, studying the lemurs there for 3 months, just out in the wilderness by herself. And I think it's so great to just dedicate oneself to understanding these animals, because to understand them and be with them and see life through their eyes, that's really what love and I think real wisdom is to get out of our own little narrative, essentially, or our own little perspective, and see a bigger perspective. So this is something Gina has done. So I want to thank her for the work that she's doing, and just invite her to talk a little bit about her work and her perspective on veganism and the connection between veganism and animals living in the wild. And then, of course, if you have any questions yourselves, feel free to press *6, and we can talk to Gina. So I'm going to go ahead and unmute your phone now, Gina. So let's see if this works. Are you there? Hello. I think you're unmuted. I'm not sure. Let's see if you're working here. Gina, are you there? All right. So, well, her phone is unmuted, and this can happen. I'm not exactly sure what's going on. But let me just quickly check here one thing. Okay, let's see. All right, so I'm just going to send her a quick email here. All right. So anyway, well, okay, so hopefully she'll come on at some point because her phone is unmuted. And sometimes people, I think, don't realize that. I'm not sure what, anyway. But, okay, let's go ahead and shift gears. Oh, wait, you know what? I think I did the wrong thing. I just think I muted the wrong person. Here we go. My mistake.
Hi, Will.
Here we go. You know what? You have a very similar name to somebody else, and I just realized that I unmuted the wrong. Okay, sorry about that, everybody. Okay, so let's go and continue on. Thank you. My mistake. So, Gina, you heard my introduction, and would you like to, is there anything you'd like to just go ahead and say to start off?
Yeah, sure. Thank you so much for introducing me to the group and your lovely introduction of Lolita and her apparel in that horrible concrete tank in Miami Sea Aquarium. And I want to just start off by commending you on the World Peace Guide. I'm sure you've heard this millions of times, but it's very inspirational for me. And it's one of the most comprehensive and logical arguments I've ever heard for attaining a vegan lifestyle. It's the most important solution to save ourselves spiritually and to save thousands of species from extinction, including our own, by the simple action of not exploiting animals for food and entertainment and labor and research and so forth. So
right.
Veganism really is the best way to end cruelty in the world. And I personally have found that when I make it a point to connect with anything natural in my daily life, that I can actually live the vegan lifestyle in a much better way. When I think what I'm doing every day, whether I'm hurting or helping animals, helps me put the spirituality in me in perspective. So thank you for the book. And thank you for allowing me to speak on Lolita's behalf.
Right, right. So has there been, as far as you know, any progress made with Lolita at this point? I'm just curious. Is it still basically a stalemate?
No, not at all. Every day there's some activism going on. And most recently, the Lummi Nation, they are the tribal people, the Native American people of Puget Sound. They have notified the Miami Sea Aquarium that they have an intent to sue if they do not release Lolita. And they are accusing, many have done before, including Orca Network and PETA, that, they are harming and harassing her. And she was abducted or kidnapped, which is a legal violation to their Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. So
great.
By doing that, it's another legal avenue to getting her out of there. One of the major problems in releasing her is the lack of support from the marine biologists to her retirement plan. And I don't know how many people really know about Lolita, but I'll go over, a little bit about the book and why I wrote it. But the marine biologists are not convinced wholeheartedly that she won't be harmed in the transport process to be released into a sanctuary in her home waters. So that's a major hurdle. And so anyone who is a marine biologist out there on this call, I would please urge you to go to orcanetwork.org and look at her retirement plan to see if, you would agree to that it poses no major risk to her health if she were released back home to rejoin her family. And her mother is about 90 years old. And
wow.
She's the oldest living orca right now. And she is the matriarch or leader of Lolita's pod in the wild. There are three pods, J, K, and L pod, and L pod has the most number of orcas, and her mother is the leader of that pod. It's a very touching and heartfelt story, Lolita's plight, because her mother, I believe, communicates with her every day. And I believe that the orcas are telepathic and they can talk to one another whether or not they're physically, within range.
Wow.
But yeah. So So that's one thing. The plan offers to recondition her to use her sonar, use her echolocation to hunt for salmon. So, you know, those skills for an orca are learned by their families when they're very, very young, from the time they're born to about the age of, I don't know, well, forever, actually. Then she learned those skills. Those skills were owned in her memory from the time she was born to the time she was kidnapped at about 4 to 6 years old. So okay. I just want to say a little bit, I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. I was wondering how old she was. So she was about 4 to 6 years old when she
She was captured on August 8th, 1970. But now she is over 50, and she's been in that tank for about 50 years.
Wow.
It's very sad. And but the book is written with a ray of hope, obviously, because I believe that she believes that there is possibility that they will release her. So Lolita is also the second oldest orca in captivity, and she's been in that tank, like I said, since 1970. And she spent her first 4 to 6 years as a free wild orca, and she was nurtured by her mother, who we call Ocean Sun. And her mother is still alive today. A little bit about and the book. And the reason I did write this book primarily is I wanted children and also adults to try to view animals from their perspective, because a lot of people think this is anthropomorphic and it's wrong, but if we don't do that, then we don't really understand how they could feel. So there's a lot of dialogue between orcas in there, and I wanted also to write the book to honor her and her family of 73 southern resident orcas. And essentially it's a book about the love between orca families, and it's also a love story between her and Hugo, who is another member of L-Pod, who was captured, I believe, about 3 years before she was. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that is, and there's another really important. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just wondering, has your book and other books like yours and films that are trying to raise awareness about the abuse of these very intelligent marine mammals like the orcas, has that really worked to reduce the number of people who are paying to go watch her? Because that's really the problem. I mean, people are still paying to go and just be there and watch her swim around in this little tank. How is that going, do you think?
Well, that's going, I think, quite well, because SeaWorld, as everyone knows, is tanking. Their sales, their ticket sales, are really plummeting since the release of Blackfish, the movie about, you know, the injustices of orcas in the tanks, it's working, because after Blackfish came out, I believe in, what was it, 2014 or somewhere around there, and that's how I got involved in the movement, was I watched the film, and I didn't really know much about orcas because it's not in my background. I'm not a cetacean researcher. And I was in tears when I watched what they did to these magnificent, sentient, very, very sensitive animals in those tanks. And a lot of people got on board and used the best skills they could to try to stop cetacean captivity. And in Canada, they just stopped it. It was just announced that it's now banned in Canada. And I think Indonesia, the Dolphin Project's really active in getting the dolphins that were captured released back into the ocean and freed. So there's a lot of progress being made on a daily basis. In Russia, they've captured whales, and now they're releasing them back into the ocean. So all this information can be found. Yeah, and that's just recent. These orcas are illegally captured, and now they have to put them back. And the government says, well, now it's the law, so you have to do it. But it takes time. It takes time for the world to have that attitude shift and learn to respect cetaceans.
So it's still legal in the United States to capture orcas and take them out of the water?
I don't think we've had a capture in a long time, but I don't know about the legal parameters. I know that they can transport them, but in California, there is a ban on orca captivity and transport, so you're not allowed to do that anymore in California, and I think in New York, and there may be in other states as well, but I'm not positive about that because, I do my best to keep abreast of these issues, but I'm primarily a writer and a researcher.
It was great to see that recently, AAA, which is just the American Automobile Association, which is kind of like a tourist agency, they no longer will tell anybody about SeaWorld. They've gone on board to just basically protest against SeaWorld and not include SeaWorld as a place to go because of the abuse of animals. So I think it's really, when it hits that level of mainstream, it's saying a lot, I think. People are waking up.
Definitely, absolutely. Even United Airlines has stopped ties with SeaWorld. So they're all canceling their contracts one by one. But Miami Sea Aquarium is a very small company. They are a subsidiary of Palace Entertainment, who's the parent company of Parques Reunidos, and they are the most unwilling institution to cooperate. So that's why there's one lawsuit after another. I also wanted to let people know of the current situation of the Chinook salmon that is causing the southern resident orcas, the 73 of them, to go extinct. So I'm not sure if people are aware of this, but it's the hottest topic right now surrounding the orcas. There are four dams. They are called the Lower Snake River dams, and they are preventing the orcas from feeding on salmon because there's not enough salmon. They're blocked by the dam. The adult can't swim upstream to spawn, and then if they do spawn, the juveniles and the young, they can't swim downstream to reach the orcas. So it's just a horrific situation, and the orcas are dying one by one every year. Now, we had 76, and now there are only 73. Two males were just died, and they are in their prime, and they just died. And
starving to death, basically, right? I mean, they're just
yeah.
Starving.
There's no food, and because one dam can open up millions of salmon. And there are four of them, so they're working really hard to breach one of them by the end of the year. That's the only ray of hope, is to breach the four Lower Snake River dams. And I don't know if the listeners did hear about the young whale who had a baby her calf lasted maybe a half an hour, and she died, and she carried her calf on her rostrum for 17 days, showing the world that the orcas are dying. Her name was Talaqua. And her mother, who was the matriarch of her pod, J-pod, just died recently, too. So, when you take out the matriarch, the whole pod is in danger of extinction.
Right.
So... you know,
thanks for telling us about that. That's really important to be aware of, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, and anyone can get more information on the dams, or, you know, write their elected officials, especially around Washington State and California, to encourage them to breach one dam, because the orcas have only at most probably, you know, even less than 5 years left to survive if they don't have enough Chinook, and they're going further and further away from the San Juan Islands to look for food. They were only spotted, I think, 5 times in the spring and summer this year, which is unheard of. They're usually around all the time feeding, and the tourists can see them on the boat. But now they have to go further and further north for food, and it's very sad to see them drop one by one.
Right. Wow. Well, thanks so much for sharing about that. I think we should begin to wrap up. Do you want to share anything about just anything else, or like it might be interesting to share a little bit about how your life was changed by going to Africa and living with the animals there, and, you know, just, you know, how that happened. I think it sounds like a fascinating story.
Oh, thank you. Well, I wanted to study animals at a very early age, and so I went to Africa. That was I was invited into a doctorate program. At the time, I had a master's, and I wanted to just do more research on animals. So they invited me into the program, and they said that, well, if you you can't just work for us, you have to be in the program. So I went to Africa. I lived among the lemurs, the ring-tailed lemurs and the safakas, the Verroes safakas, and I lived in a tent. I had the company of another researcher, and I went out there, similar to what Jane Goodall does to observe the animals and be with them, and just the connection of being out there with nature and being in their environment, being under their social network was paradise for me, because, you know, the animals are very tolerant of humans. They don't have to be tolerant. They don't have to let me follow them every day. They could just, I mean, if we wouldn't do that we wouldn't surely invite an animal to follow us around every day. So I found that, it was just, it was magical being there, and they accepted me, and I could follow them every day. And sometimes even the juveniles, they would look back and say, well, are you coming with us? Yeah, and then they, you know, I would follow them for as long as I could, so that was my African experience. I learned to really, I didn't turn vegan until about 4 years ago, and we can't turn back the clock, but I do regret not coming to that spiritual revelation before that. And although I was in nature, and I did respect the animals, that I observed every day, but I didn't see the connection with the other animals in the world. And I think people need to see that all animals are really alike. And this book is written not only for Lolita, but it's written for all animals, because we have to stop treating them this way and learn to respect and live together in harmony with them. The book is something that I worked on for about 4 years, and it's one of the most important publications that I've ever written. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much for telling us about your book and your experiences. If anyone would like to ask a question of Gina, just press *6 on your phone if you have a comment or a question for Gina. We're about at the end of our time here, so I wanted to just kind of Again, thank you so much, Gina. I don't see any hands being raised at this point. People sometimes just like to listen. And but I think it sounds, you know, to me it's like one of just so many different aspects of the way that we commercialize animals in nature and to somehow just raise the light of awareness like you're doing so that people can just not only not support it, but actually pass laws prohibiting these kinds of things. And I think it's beginning to happen. You know, Rick O'Berry, the Dolphin Project founder, I've known him for years, and he used to work so hard in Taiji, which is in Japan, and other places to try to just raise awareness. And I think it's happening more and more. You know, people are waking up. So I'm going to go ahead and unmute Lily. She's just raised her hand and just see if she has a comment here. Yes, oh. Lily.
Oh, thank Hi. You. Oh, thank you so much for having Gina as a guest and that heartbreaking story. How do we get your book? I must have missed it. How do we get it? How does the public get it?
Oh, well, it's very easily accessible. You can go on Amazon and that's sold on all the in all the countries that Amazon operates. It's also at the libraries, Sonoma and Solano County Library Systems. Also at
And the name of the book is Lolita?
Lolita Loves the Ocean.
A Lolita Loves the Ocean. Okay.
The Story of a Wild Orca. So I think most people get it on Amazon. But
And how do you spell your name? Gina, G-I-N-A?
Correct.
Uh-huh.
And the
last name?
Is Cicada, S-E-Q-U-E-I-R-A.
Okay. Well, thank you for writing that. And it was just a joy to hear you.
Oh,
and a sadness to hear you, like right. Will said, you know, you experience all of your pain so that, and all of your pleasure, they're all part of the same thing, really.
Right. Yeah, and I think, you know, ultimately how we treat animals is a reflection of our respect for life. So if we can, in our daily lives, connect with nature, go out more, observe the birds and the trees and the squirrels. Even if you live in a urban environment, you can still connect with nature as long as you become aware of it. And thank you. Thank you for listening to the whole plight of animals. And I believe that we are, you know, we can become caretakers of the planet to nurture and protect all animals. If we are, you know, aware, if we become connected with nature, we can all become mothers of the earth.
Right. And I think it's so important to, like you say, to be concerned and to try to do something for these animals, the orcas. But I also feel that the salmon, even in their own right, I mean, besides the fact that they're part of a food web that would support the orcas, but these poor salmon, I mean, they're sentient beings too, and their lives become hell for them. They can't fulfill their natural inclinations and yearnings, and they get stuck, and they, you know, they just die unfulfilled in a sense. They can't really breed. And they're living in really polluted waters more and more. I mean, it's just a breakdown of on every level. But I think it's so important to include the fishes also in our compassion, not just the mammals, but also the fishes, because they're probably the most abused animals on the planet in some ways.
Absolutely. You know, when I read your book that said 80 million tons of sea creatures are killed each year in the U.S. We're talking also about millions and millions of salmon that are killed because of these dams. And the salmon, you know, they represent, when they migrate from the sea to the rivers, they represent the greatest transfer of nutrients from the ocean to the forest.
Really?
So,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. And they care, and this is it's in Alaska, and happens every spring and fall
So so I love fish, and I just I don't want to see them needlessly killed for human consumption. And
right.
You know, it's horrific, the number of individuals that are killed in bycatch, and it's totally unavoidable if we just revert back to our vegan lifestyle.
Right, right. That's the key. Wow. All right. Well, thanks so much, Gina. It's been a delight to have you with us. And quite a few people, of course, this whole call is recorded, so there'll be people listening over the next, you know, the days and weeks ahead, too, to what you're saying, besides everybody on the call now. So I guess nobody else has raised their hand at this point. So I guess, we'll just close here, unless you have a final word. You want to say something?
Well, I just wanted to thank everyone for listening in, and blessings to everyone who has, you know, done in any way they can use their special skills to help animals out of the gracious cruelty that the humans have put them in, and blessings to everyone.
All right. Thanks so much, Gina, and well said, and we really appreciate you writing this book and all the other work you're doing to help raise awareness about our impact on animals. Thanks.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you later. Yeah, thanks. All right, so that was very enlightening, and I just something about what we're doing to these magnificent creatures. You know, there's a good book by Jeffrey Mason, Masson, I believe is how it's pronounced, and he's written quite a few books about animals. Why Elephants Weep is one he's known for, but he wrote a recent book. More recent, actually, it's been a few years, but the main point he makes in the beginning of the book is he's comparing the two sort of, I guess they would be called the apex species on land and on the water. He says on land, it's human beings, and the water, it's orcas. And he was just sort of showing the difference in the way we operate. He said, you know, humans are killing literally thousands and millions of their own species, and no orca has ever killed another orca, ever. You know, it's like they don't have any, you know, they don't have the kind of psychology, I guess you'd say, that imprisons other beings or attacks their own kind and all these other things. And he said the whole point he went on in the book was to really show that our idea of us as human beings being superior to animals, this superior idea that we are lords and superior and they're just so infinitely far below us, is actually something that you can't really back that up in scientifically in very well. I mean, you know, science can be used in any way, like for religion, it's the same thing, you can use it. But there's so many capacities that animals have that are absolutely magnificent and that allow them to really contribute enormously to other animals and to each other. And there's this underlying sort of harmonious interplay that we see in all around us. And I think this is the great challenge probably that we feel as human beings. It's like, what, you know, why are we so completely at odds in many ways with the creation, with the beautiful interconnected celebration of life here, and destroying it so quickly and so harshly? And so I get that basic in Zen, it's called a koan, a question that just keeps itching and you can't quite answer it. That koan is, I think, what drove me to write the World Peace Diet, to try to get to the bottom of it as best I could and to share some ideas that we need to look deeply into not only the consequences of animal agriculture in the outer world, to the environment and to animals and to other people and starvation and war and so forth, but what it does to us spiritually and psychologically, ethically. And it's really fascinating, I think, to see how our social institutions like slavery, which we work so hard to stop, essentially, and we outlaw, you know, slavery is now outlawed, and yet the irony, the bitter irony is that we have actually more slavery today than we've ever had, probably ever, in the history of human beings. There's vast numbers of human beings who are literally owned by others and as property for work, or who are trafficked for work or for sexual reasons, but it's for primarily for money and for domination. You know, millions of people are being trafficked. So children and women and men, I mean, okay, and a lot of it is animal agriculture and other forms of agriculture and work and sexual trafficking. I mean, I've spent some time in the last year or so just looking into trafficking, and I just think the average person has no idea how vast and extensive it is, but this is what we're doing to animals. You know, they're being trafficked. And this trafficking of animals is continuing, imprisoning them, having them be born into captivity. That's the thing that behind, in the back of my mind, I always feel, is people go to a zoo to see the poor prisoners, that only prisoners would ever go there. I mean, only someone who's imprisoned would ever find that something interesting or entertaining. That someone who is free, a free liberated human being, would just try to liberate them, you know, try to let them go. They would be beside themselves with shock and remorse that we're doing. They're like, why are you putting these animals in jail? And they didn't do anything and to hurt anybody. And what's this all about? And yet the fact the narrative just normalizes this kind of really insane behavior by us, and we bring our children to show them the animals. I remember doing that as a kid, going to the zoo and seeing the elephant with a chain around her foot. And just looking, and adults around me were saying, yeah, look at this, isn't this amazing? Now you're getting to learn about nature and animals. And I understand now what I'm learning. I'm just learning to dominate and exploit animals and nature. That's what we teach our children. So I'm so grateful that we're awakening out of those narratives. Slowly but surely here. So, all right, everybody. So, let's see. Does anyone have anything you'd like to talk about? Because I have plenty that I would like to share. We're now almost to the hour, so we don't have that much more time. So press *6 if you want to ask a question or make a comment or share a concern or share a joy. There's several things that I wanted to cover, so I will do that in the meantime because I think it's important. One of the things that I've been seeing a lot of people ask me about it and wonder what I think, and it's one of those subjects that's very complicated, and we could talk a long time about it. Maybe I'll devote a whole call to this at some point, but that is this whole thing about lab-grown meat and the future of meat. That, you know, is this really something that we should embrace as vegans? The idea that let's just sort of give up with trying to get people to go vegan and eat a plant-based diet. Let's find some kind of a technological fix and create meat that people can eat by creating laboratories. Large-scale industrial plants where meat is grown in a sort of clean environment, and I put a link here on the on page 2 of the resources for August 2019. It's about halfway down on page 2. It's called Vegan Spill the Truth About Lab-Grown Meat. It's a panel discussion with four people that I respect quite a bit, actually, at the Vegetarian Summer Fest, or Vegan Summer Fest, last month in July. Dr. Milton Mills, some of you know of him, Lee Hall, who's a lawyer, Harold Brown, who's a former farmer, and I think a very committed animal activist, who we've actually toured with Harold Brown, and all over Iowa. We went to Iowa together, and he stayed with us in our RV and had quite a time. Anyway, he's a good friend of ours. And then also Joanne Farb led the discussion, and her daughter, Serena Farb, who is vegan from birth, has now graduated from college and has a degree in biology, so she's a biologist. All talked about lab-grown meat, and I have to say it wasn't a debate. I mean, all four people are absolutely opposed to this whole idea of lab-grown meat, and they were very articulate. I'm not sure since there wasn't anybody on the other side to defend lab-grown meat. It was a pretty one-sided argument, but there were so many different aspects that I wasn't aware of that I thought were very interesting. I'll just say a couple of them briefly because I think we're going to be hearing about this more and more. First of all, there is no lab-grown meat at this point, basically. I mean, there is a little bit, but it cost $2 million to make the first 6 ounces or something like that. So there's just tiny amounts. There's no way to make it at this point. The idea, I guess, is that they're going to scale methods. And the main points they were making, I can sort of summarize briefly, is that environmentally, it's not much of an improvement. It could be somewhat of an improvement. It takes, obviously, it's an environmental nightmare to actually grow living animals and kill them. It takes enormous quantities of grain. So they're saying it would take a lot less grain, but the people who advocate for this, but these people were saying actually it's going to take enormous quantities of grain to actually make lab-grown meat. They went into in not only of grain, but of energy. So unless it's some kind of solar power that's renewable, but if the amount of energy that it will take, and I guess the thing that Milton Mills kept emphasizing besides the energy was the danger, the extreme danger of this, because these are going to have to be large-scale industrial plants where everything is hyper clean because you're growing tissue. So everybody has to wear suits where there's no germs, and there's extreme danger of all kinds of strange bacteria and viruses and things emerging out of this process. And so he was saying the expense of and the amount of energy to keep these gigantic facilities completely free of bacteria, so that because the growth mediums, it's all going to be everything has to be sterilized. So the technological challenges are just absolutely enormous. The energy demand is going to be enormous, and then he was saying the actual food itself is meat, so it's full of saturated fat and cholesterol. And it's very unhealthy. So one of the reasons, of course, I guess, why it's a very popular idea is that Big Pharma is in favor, because people will still be getting diabetes and osteoporosis and liver disease and kidney disease and heart disease and cancer and everything else that people get from eating animal foods, because they'll be eating animal foods. And then, of course, from a philosophical point of view, it's reinforcing the idea that we human beings should be eating the flesh of animals. When the whole idea, of course, in the vegan movement is, no, we don't need to be eating the flesh of animals. That's like demonic. What the heck are we doing? It's not necessary to do that. So why, as vegans, would we be promoting this kind of meat and this kind of stuff when we can already create foods that the average person and even experts can't even tell the difference, right? I mean, it's Beyond Beef and some of these other ones. They can't tell on blind tests which one is the real meat and which one is the plant-based meat. So we already have plant-based meat that nobody can tell the difference. So I think, personally, they made a good point, some good points here. And the most important thing, I think, though, is for us to continue to raise awareness about the consequences of animal agriculture for the animals and the fact that we can thrive and be healthy and live on a fraction of the land in this way, and by moving to a plant-based ethical vegan way of living. So, I think that's a very interesting panel to watch if you have the time to do it. It's about 45 minutes, I think. And there was also just to have a chance to look right above that. The Shakinin School in Tekos, Russia. I think this is so beautiful. I mean, I just love the idea of schools that are really healthy and supportive of children. That to me is such an amazing, important, critical element in the awakening of humanity. I think schools, in fact, two of our good friends, John and Christina, up in Vancouver, in Victoria, sent me these books by John Taylor Gatto, Weapons of Mass Instruction and the Underground History of American Education. They just came in the mail a couple of days ago. And I've been going through them, but, you know, this guy, Gatto, he won the award, the highest award in New York State for being the greatest teacher. And he, after 30 years of teaching, he got that award and he quit. He said, you know, this educational system is nothing but a prison. Talk about prisons. He said it's designed to destroy the intelligence and creativity of human beings. That is its purpose. And I tell you, read these books and his experiences of the administration and what he tried to do and how he goes into the history actually of public education and how the whole idea behind it is to create people who will not question the official narrative, who will do what they're told, and who will fulfill functions within society that work for those who are running things. And so the Shatinin School in Tekos, Russia, I just love it because this is a school. This is, to me, it's like the most radical of all schools because it's based, this guy Shatinin, he's the educator. He's a beautiful old guy with gray hair and kind of like a little wizard. But he just trusts children so profoundly, and so in this school, the children teach themselves. I mean, that's basically it, and they don't have classes in the normal way. The older kids teach the younger kids, and they do it by building and creating. They built their own school. They build everything, and they work together. And apparently, the level of their actual academic and intellectual achievements is so far beyond anything anyone achieves in any kind of public educational system. And so I think it's very interesting. One of the things I've seen, having been to Russia myself and having been to China also, and it's just so ironic that these cultures that are seen as being so threatening to us, not like they're our enemies, but in a way they have beautiful things happening in them too that we could learn from, but we never do because we're not allowed to even say anything positive about Russia or China. But there's tremendously positive things happening in these countries, and again, we don't hear about it. So my old refrain, I keep saying, don't trust the media, don't believe what you're being told. We have to find out from each other in a sort of a grassroots way. And that's one of my main passions, really, in this whole work is the importance of grassroots education and how we can, as individuals, each one of us can be the leader of the vegan movement, right? Each one of us can be the leader of the vegan movement because we are our own movement, each one of us. Each one of us, we work together in the vegan movement, but we each have our own, in a sense, our own movement. We have our own unique a network of friends and our own unique talents and abilities and capacities to contribute. And so we can plug into the larger world, but we are ourselves empowered individuals. And I think that's the kind of thing we need. There's a pretty guy I also have right above that, actually, Lauren Ornelas, who I think you all know. She's the founder of a animal rights group here in the Bay Area. She worked for years with Viva. And she had a talk at the Animal Rights Conference, which was a few weeks ago in Washington, D.C., which I didn't go to. But it's a short talk on reviving the grassroots animal advocacy movement. And I think she makes some good points. And it was interesting because she said that her own group that she started herself, which I'm drawing a blank on for some reason right now, but anyway, that it's she started having chapters, like a chapter. It's based here in the Bay Area, but they started a chapter in Washington, D.C. And I really have to admire her because she said, she told the people in Washington, D.C., we're disbanding our chapter. We don't want to create a bunch of chapters. Because she was talking about colonialism, and this is something that I thought of actually beforehand when I was thinking about how my own mind had been colonized growing up, and how the European colonial powers developed this system, essentially, of moving into an area that they wanted to exploit, and then basically destroying the foundations of the existing culture. And this has probably been going on before the Europeans. It goes back before, I think. This is basically animal agricultural operations. If you read, not only in the World Peace Diet, I talk about the spread of the animal agriculture, but there's another book, which I'll tell you in a minute. Gosh, remember that book. It's Animal Exploitation and Human Violence, that book. He wrote about how animal agriculture would spread and, in a sense, colonize non-animal agricultural people, people who would eat a more plant-based diet, and they would colonize them. They would kind of take them over and force them to adopt their way of living. And so more and more people started eating meat and dairy. And so this colonial enterprise, and I saw, you know, we see it all as we travel, like in India and Vietnam and China, countries that were basically plant-based eating. And now the, you know, McDonald's and Burger King are moving in, and the churches are moving in. Everybody, they're all eating meat, you know, the ministers and the priests and the government officials, and it's sort of the movies and the corporations. It's all promoting animal agriculture. And this colonial sort of brainwashing of the indigenous people that their traditional way of living was primitive and they were weak, they should, you know, and so forth. And so anyway, she was saying that in many ways, the large animal rights groups or animal welfare groups in the United States and Europe and so forth, they do the same thing. They colonize the vegan movement. And if you're going to do something in the movement, you want to get a job, you want to work in the movement, well, I'm going to go work for Mercy for Animals or PETA or one of these groups. And they have local chapters, and you kind of, but they have an agenda. They have basically have a corporate agenda in many ways. I mean, they're not all bad, but I have seen it happen over and over again that people who are very idealistic and open-minded and empowered go to work for an animal group, and pretty soon they're just, I hate to say it, but they're kind of like just working a job where they're doing what they're told to do, and they can't really color outside the lines in terms of questioning the official narrative of animal. Very often it's animal welfare, like we're working to improve the living conditions of chickens and, you know, free-range hens or whatever. And whereas before that, maybe they worked completely against that, but now they're making a living. And so I've seen this happening over and over again. They're making a living with one of these groups, and they're being colonized. And the whole animal rights movement is, in a sense, being colonized, I think, by the money that comes through and flows through the larger organizations, which can, you know, are much more efficient at raising funds. So that's why Madeline and I spent so much time traveling to the grassroots, you know, working with the local meetup groups and the local groups, because we just think, you know, this is where the real work is happening. They're putting on their local veg fests, and we're going and encouraging local restaurants to carry vegan options, and they're educating, they're having cooking classes. You know, this is great. You know, this is where things really happen. And this is, you know, the idea of the empowered individual to me is, and then as individuals creating communities, you know, working together. And that's something else I've been thinking, Madeline and I have been thinking about quite a bit, is vegan community. You know, we don't have enough vegan community where people can actually go and live in a vegan community. We're thinking about how we would like to live in a vegan community. And there aren't that many, you know. I mean, like we're thinking of, we think of a number of different ones, but there's like the farm in Tennessee where I live. I mean, it's a beautiful place, really, and they've got like 2,000 acres of land and basically vegetarian friendly. I mean, you can kind of, it's not a vegan community, but it's pretty, you know, it'd be pretty good. They have a big vegan business there, the book publishing company, but it's not vegan anymore like it was when I was there. And but otherwise, if you go online and look at most of the communities, there's hundreds of communities, thousands of communities, really. But most of them are omnivorous. They people eat whatever they want. And so I'm wondering why it's so hard to get vegan communities, because I think physical community, that's why I went vegan. I went to a vegan community. I saw everybody eating vegan, and I went vegan. You know, it was like, well, I went vegetarian, actually. And then the Buddhist monastery was a vegan community also. And so there are quite a few communities, like the whole Supreme Master Qinghai Network, that's all vegan. The whole Thich Nhat Hanh Network is basically vegan. The Taiwanese Buddhist tradition is all basically vegan. And the Chinese also, and pretty much the Korean as well. The Vietnamese is pretty much vegan. So there are these large, but you have to be a monk or a nun pretty much to live in those communities. So I think, the time has come for more vegan communities. So if any of you have any thoughts about that or ideas in that direction, I think this is something that is very healthy for us to be talking about. And I wanted to bring that up here on the call. And what else? So there was a few other things. So yeah, please feel free to have a look at the resources for the month of 2019. And let's see, there was another thing that I just want to draw to everybody's attention is the fact that on September 16th, which is coming up, right? I mean, that's right around the corner. That's before our next call, because our next call is going to be on the 19th. So on the 16th, you all know what September 16th is. That's the International Day of the premiere of this film, The Game Changers, which everybody has been waiting for with bated breath. We've been holding our breath literally for 3 years waiting for this film to come out. It's the James Cameron film with the greatest vegan athletes, and it's one of those films that's going to put the final nail in the coffin of that absurd, ridiculous idea that vegans are pale and weak and sickly and, you know, all that kind of thing. Because people say, oh, they don't get enough protein, what are those poor vegans? So I haven't seen the film, but I've just, seen some of the clips from it, and it looks to me like it's going to be a tour de force, a great film to show the most powerful, strongest, most endurance and so forth athletes are vegan, and so many of them are vegan. And in fact, Rip Esselstyn, we just went on the cruise with Rip, and it was so great to see that he just set, 2 weeks ago, I think, a new world swimming record for the backstroke in his age group. He set a world record. And I think his age group is like 55 to 60 or something like that, or somewhere in there. And so, again, the whole idea is that we're seeing very positive developments. This awakening is happening. More and more people are coming on board out of health reasons, which is, it's like Lily says, it's the back door. But when people come in the back door, they can learn more about the devastating impact of animal agriculture on animals and deepen their resolve and their motivation. So I think any other questions, raise your hand. It's so nice to that we were able to spend some time together here. And again, I'm grateful to Gina for coming on. If anyone else has something you wanted to contribute to the discussion, feel free. There's a few other things I was going to mention. One is, I think it's so cool, is the how there's all these new foods that keep emerging. You know, we've been vegans for now 40 years, 39, and this idea, like, there's this new tofu called pumfu made out of pumpkin seeds. And the idea that, you can have tofu, and it doesn't have to be from soybeans, it can be from other kinds of seeds. And we can make so many varieties of delicious milks and things. Madeline is always coming up with these new things out of the kitchen and that are plant-based. And, the sky is the limit. It's just so fantastic to see all these variations on a theme, of compassion and beauty and sustainability and health that we can make. You know, we just we put up a carrot salad. We just did that one, Madeline's Intuitive Cooking, and then another new one. When she was in Switzerland, she started experimenting with, because we, you know, we do green smoothies in the morning usually, and now the new thing is adding, taking out the greens and putting in oats, soaked oats. I mean, we have this grinder, so, you know, but soaked and ground up, and it's, I have to say, it's really fantastic. We so there's all kinds of ways we can make delicious food that is inexpensive. It's far less expensive than eating animal foods and processed foods. That is delicious and nutritious, and there's nothing stopping us. You know, it's just the narrative. It's that the narrative of that we're all unfortunately indoctrinated into. So this new, and I was really glad to see this new little major study that got major publicity, actually, that switching to a plant-based diet would allow us to feed 4 billion more people. I mean, I said this myself personally in the movie Cowspiracy, and people were arguing. They were saying, no, it's not true. You can't feed that many people. But the research is clear. I mean, if we're growing so much food and feeding it to these imprisoned animals, not only is it devastating to the rainforest and the oceans and the water and the soil, you know, all the pollution and so forth, like Gina was talking about, I mean, all this massive pollution that's flowing into the rivers. And we need, why do we need to have all these dams? Why do we need all these dams? The dams are there for animal agriculture. We have to understand that. It's for irrigation. So they can hold the water back, then they can release it for these vast fields of alfalfa for the dairy industry, these vast fields of corn and soy for the meat industry, for the cows and pigs and chickens. And factory farm fish also need huge amounts of grain that they eat and water for their whole thing. So, and eggs. I mean, all of this, and we don't see that. And then the nutrient-rich runoff, like we have this problem where we live with Clear Lake. It's a beautiful lake, but it's, you know, these terrible toxic algae blooms. It's from nutrient-rich runoff. What's that from? It's from, well, the vineyards, which to me are a disaster because it's alcohol, which, I mean, alcohol is primarily for people who eat animal foods because we crave alcohol if we're eating meat and dairy products. And so if we were just using vineyards to grow grapes to eat grapes and raisins, we certainly wouldn't need all those vineyards. And we could allow habitat. We're just seeing the massive destruction of forests where we live in Lake County, Sonoma County, Napa County, all around here, Mendocino County, for vineyards. And it's basically an extension of the animal agriculture, wine and cheese and steak and brew and highballs and all this stuff. And but the other thing is the enormous amount of land and water going to animal agriculture and causing pollution, going into Clear Lake, is from the dairy industry and the cattle industry. So the whole idea underlying everything is that when you look deep enough, you'll always find animal agriculture as the driving force of environmental problems, cultural problems, of shortages, of hunger, and the interconnectedness of all these things with an educational system that dumps people down, because the basic whole idea of animal agriculture is don't make the connection. Don't just eat what you're told to eat. And again, questioning all these things. And I see it all the time. People in the vegan movement don't really want to question. I mean, it's great that we're questioning eating animal foods, but I think we should be questioning a lot of other things. I'm among them, for example, mandatory vaccinations. You know, mandatory vaccinations on factory farms for cows and pigs and chickens, and pretty soon it's happening to us. And I just read an article by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., which was brilliant. I mean, he really shows how much he cares about children, and how the industry, the four large pharmaceutical companies. Which you all know what they are, GlaxoSmithKline and Merck and Pfizer and Sandoval, they make billions and billions of dollars in profits on pharmaceutical on vaccinations, and vaccinations are the only drugs that do not have to be tested at all. No testing. And there's clear evidence that the autism epidemic and the whole, what did he say? I mean, it was amazing. Like before 1986 and that law that was passed that completely just took away any financial liability from pharmaceutical companies for anyone who was harmed by a vaccine, they passed that law in 1986. Before that, there was only about 12 shots that kids got, and the percentage of kids with these serious illnesses, these ongoing illnesses, was very low. It was something like under 10%, and now it's over 50% of kids have diseases that require them to take drugs constantly. All kinds of problems. And, you know, why are we allowing this? This is the thing. Why are we not questioning all these things? This is all animal agriculture. This is all tested on animals. It's treating us like we're all on a factory farm. We don't have any rights. We have to do what we're told. And I see this over and over again on about everything. There's a certain official story that's promoted in the media. And if we question that official story, then we're somehow not allowed to be heard anymore. The censorship that's happening, and it's extending. You know, Cowspiracy and other films. You know, so I think find our own networks, hopefully, to be able to continue to communicate. And this is one of them. You know, this is sort of grassroots communication here on a call. Is really in our best interest. All right, so that's those are the things, main things I wanted to talk about here right now. And I think at this point we should probably call it an evening, and I can talk a little bit about what's coming up in the next couple of weeks. So just if you're aware of this, Madeline and I will be leaving in about a week. I think, in fact, exactly a week, in our new little van. We've been working hard. This has been a kind of a fun project. We spent a couple hours a day in the afternoon converting a van, because we had this Volkswagen bus in 1971, which was fun for me to live in. But, you know, nowadays we thought we should have something a little more reliable. So we bought this little van. It's made by Fiat, and it's called a Ram ProMaster City, and we're converting it into a little. I just put a freshwater tank underneath it and a gray water tank underneath it. And we put in, we're putting in metal into these beautiful drapes and all kinds of. Anyway, we're going to be living in that for the first time and for a week, and we're leaving on Thursday. So we'll be giving a lecture in Mount Shasta on Thursday, and then in Bend, Oregon on Friday, and then in Spokane on Saturday, and again on Sunday. And possibly in Reading on the way back down. So we're doing a little tour next week up to Spokane. And but then after that, in early September, we're doing a Midwest tour. So if you know anybody in the Midwest, we'll be speaking in Fargo. That was one of the jokes I sometimes would tell. I would say Madeline and I have been traveling, and we've spoken in every state in the United States, promoting veganism, except for one state, North Dakota. And so now we're going to North Dakota. So we're flying to Fargo, North Dakota. We're giving a lecture there on the 8th of September, and then on the 9th in Minneapolis, on the 10th in Madison, on the 11th in Chicago, the 12th in South Bend with our dear friend Catherine Perry, and on the 13th in Grand Rapids, wonderful people there. 14th in Traverse City, 15th in Traverse City, and there's some great people there. If you know the film, that's on the 16th, but Called to Rescue by Naomi Call and her son, Logan, and they're now in Traverse City, so we'll be working with them. And then on the 16th, we have the Game Changers, and so if you know anybody in the Midwest, will be in that northern Midwest will be coming through there. And then on the 21st, well, then we have our circle call on the 19th, but on the 21st, there's a vegetarian food festival in San Francisco that I'll be speaking at as well. So we have kind of a busy month coming up with lots of talks and things, and we're working. Oh, the other thing I want to mention, too, is in October, on the weekend of the 18th, 19th, and 20th, if you are interested, there's a wonderful vegan retreat center in Marin County, in West Marin, in Forest Knolls, called Banyan Grove. It's a totally vegan, beautiful place in the country, and we are on their calendar we're renting the place, basically, to put on a world peace diet meditation retreat. It'll be training the world peace diet ideas, and it'll be catered with vegan food. It'll be Friday evenings, all day Saturday and Sunday, and be finishing up Sunday afternoon. So it's a 3-day meditation retreat, October 18th, 19th, and 20th. It's open to 20 people. We can only take 20 people. So if you're interested, I haven't got it up yet, a webpage for it, but mark it in your calendar if you're interested. Send me an email if you'd like to be put on the list, or if you know anybody, because we can only take 20 people. That's as many as they can take, but it's a beautiful place, and I think it'd be great to do a training together and just spend time together meditating and talking about these ideas together. So that's in October, and we're also going up to Oregon in early October and speaking at the Portland Veg Fest. And then, of course, in November, the end of November, we're going to Asia for a whole month, to Bali and Jakarta, Singapore, Kuala Lumpur, Penang, Bangkok, Chiang Mai, and Taiwan for about 10 days. So, winter we'll be doing a southern tour, to the southern United States. My mother just had her birthday yesterday. She's 91 years old, vegan, doing well. And I know we know some wonderful elderly vegans, and it's so beautiful to see these beautiful people as they age, working, continuing to be examples for how we can live our lives in a positive way on this earth. All right, so I want to thank you all again for joining us here. I don't see any more star six hands being raised, so I'm going to go ahead and thank you all for being with us. And don't forget, if you want to listen to it, I noticed a few people came in late. If you came in late and you want to hear what we talked about earlier, you can go ahead and I'll post it on Facebook and send out an email. We have we always post the recording. There's a link to the recording, and all of our calls are recorded. All right, so much love to you all. Thanks again for joining us. We'll close with a short piece of music, just maybe a nice short one. Davis Swirl. It's only a minute and a half. And again, thanks again for joining us. As compassion encircles the earth, all beings everywhere. Please go to our circleofcompassion.org, and you can find out more about our worldwide prayer circle for animals there. All right, much love to all of you. Thanks again for joining us. It's been great.